Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
He says he gets short of breath when he moves around, but he says right after that, that's how he gets whenever he moves around anyway.
Right.
This paramedic is not racing to the scene of an emergency, but he's about to make a house call. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
What's actually in my fridge right now? Do we have yogurt or not?
Therefore, there's a code to cover that scenario.
That's not it. That's not it at all.
This is working for me. I'm gonna stick with it, baby.
Ooh, oh, there you go.
So funny.
I am a machine.
Some people go too hard. They say, like, I'm not gonna have any more sodas.
You know, you didn't have blood tests to determine whether
this interrupt this task that is probably really important.
When do I get to survive?
If you could survive,
you truly, at the end of that, you feel alive.
On today's show, keeping HIV-positive moms in treatment post-baby and exploring the great mystery of fall, brightly colored leaves. But first up, in the world of healthcare, the term superutilizer is not as cool as it sounds. It describes a small group of people who account for a huge portion of the costs in the system. These are usually patients with complex medical conditions, people who cycle in and out of the emergency room, and likely aren't getting the right level of care in the community. The medical field is trying lots of ways to cut costs while keeping these patients out of the hospital. One example, using paramedics in a different way. Here's Todd Bookman.
Nancy Nolan is wearing a neon pinkish sort of creamsicle colored fleece, which I gotta say nicely complements her magenta nail polish and gray neck brace.
Well, I have muscular dystrophy. I'm living on a respirator. It's actually a life support system. And other than that, I'm pretty healthy.
Other than that?
I can't walk, I can't breathe, but other than that, I'm healthy.
Nancy, who is 68 and in a wheelchair, lives in Dedham, just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. When she does need medical care, she coordinates it through a local agency called Commonwealth Care Alliance. It's a nonprofit that uses federal and state money to treat low-income people with complex medical conditions.
I didn't feel good one day, so I texted Dr. John and I said, I'm not feeling good at all. He goes, well, let me send the paramedic out. And I was like, what? You're going to send a paramedic to the house? He says, they're good. I go, are you sure? And he goes, really? They're very nice. You like them. And so I was very nervous.
For the past year, Commonwealth has been using EaseCare, a private ambulance company, to do after-hours house calls. While Commonwealth has a team of nurses who do home visits during the day, they don't staff the overnight. And so, for a lot of patients, medical care in the evening meant a trip to the emergency room, even when it wasn't an emergency.
Wherever possible, our patients said to us, if we can, we'd like to be home. And this program really enabled us to do that.
Toyin Ajaye is one of Commonwealth's doctors and is helping lead the program. The concept of community paramedicine, using paramedics to provide care in people's homes, is catching on in both rural and now urban areas around the country. She says it's kind of a no-brainer.
They are highly skilled. They're mobile. They're used to taking care of people in the community. They're used to, you know, home settings on the street. They're flexible by their nature.
The paramedics get hundreds of hours of special training, learning everything from wound care to managing chronic conditions like diabetes. Then on certain shifts, they forgo the adrenaline of an ambulance and instead make house calls in a van or SUV.
East Care Quarterline, this is Lauren.
Hey, Lauren, it's Joe in MH1.
Hey.
Hey, I guess I have a call.
Joe Sequeira is stuck in rush hour traffic on Interstate 93. No flashing lights, no sirens.
It is a very different approach. It's a different mindset. On an ambulance, your mindset is to stabilize the patient and get the patient to the hospital quickly. Where with a community paramedic, you're talking to a nurse practitioner and a doctor, and it's all about treating
the patient at home, at bedside.
After a bit of trouble finding the address, we pull up to the home of tonight's first patient. He lives in a rough part of town, an otherwise rundown apartment spruced up with Elvis paraphernalia on the walls. The guy is in his mid-60s, with a history of serious heart and lung disease. He's on oxygen, but is complaining of shortness of breath.
Have you been eating and drinking okay? Yeah. Okay, what about going to the bathroom, moving your bowels, and urinating? No problem urinating?
Sequeira has been an EaseCare medic for 13 years. He's got plenty of experience with car accidents and heart attacks. But he says he actually now looks forward to the more low-key nights, where he can work with patients, not on patients. From the back of his truck, he grabs portable equipment and a laptop. He's got access to the patient's electronic medical records, which helps him better understand the situation.
I'll do your vital signs first. We'll start with that.
You want me to?
Nope, you can stay. Nope, you can sit right there. That's fine. Just gonna, you know, do simple stuff. You know, check your temp, check your O2 saturation, blood pressure, stuff like that.
Once he gets readings and does a simple blood workup, Sequeira calls up both the on-call doctor and the night nurse. And the team, together over the phone, figures out a plan.
I mean, the cam looked okay.
Like I said, other than the H&H was a little bit low, his TCO2 was a little high. It was 41.
We spend 2 hours at this guy's house, a lot of time, but it saves everyone the expense and stress of a hospital visit.
Instead of him getting worked up and going to the ER tonight and calling 911, talk to the doc. He's going to get doubled up on his diuretic and stay home for the night and get followed up with tomorrow. And maybe even get another visit from one of us tomorrow night just to check up on him.
As good as tonight seemingly goes, there are barriers to more paramedics doing home visits. There's state regulations that can get in the way, and a clunky insurance system not set up to cover this kind of care. Some hospitals, though, say the math of health reform means it's worth figuring community paramedicine out. For example, Methodist Hospital in South Philadelphia is launching a small trial program to check in on patients recently discharged. Dr. Andrew Miller is spearheading the effort and says the potential cost savings are big.
Let me put it in perspective for you. If a pilot like this to run for a few months costs us $25,000 and an automobile, you need to prevent 2 readmissions to recoup that cost. So I hope that answers the question.
There's a phrase every healthcare executive uses today. In every interview and speech, they offer some variation of, we need to deliver the right care in the right place at the right time. Patients like Nancy Nolan use slightly less polished language to describe community paramedicine.
So it was really fabulous. Really fabulous. I hate going to the hospital. Literally hate it.
Nancy's going to stay at home. Her medical care can come to her. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
If you're trying to improve care by utilizing resources you already have, and if you happen to be in Nashville, songwriting capital of the world, then music is one of your biggest assets. So in Music City, songwriting has become part of therapy for female veterans who are dealing with the trauma of sexual assault they suffered while in the military. Reporter Emily Siner joined one of the sessions.
The conference room inside a Nashville VA center feels clinical. The walls are beige. The carpet is gray. The chairs are creaky. But today, there's an energy here that you might feel more often at an intimate Nashville club. 2 dozen people, mostly women, are sitting in those creaky chairs in a circle. Some of them hold guitars. About half are veterans, and they're waiting to debut their very personal songs about a shared experience, sexual assault.
So my instance happened when I was stationed in Korea, and it was my boss.
Sarah Kelly is a 33-year-old Army veteran.
And then when I went to my company commander, he told me, welcome to Korea, get used to it. So I lost my voice.
Kelly tells the group she used to sing and write songs on her own. That hasn't happened since her assault.
I'm terrified to be in front of you and singing, but also kind of excited that I get to do it again.
Yeah.
She puts in a CD of her recording and sings along. The songwriter she was paired with strums behind her.
I've always been told, keep it to yourself. If you've got a problem, don't ever tell.
Kelly's assault was 14 years ago, and she still has nightmares. She says she sometimes hallucinates there's someone in her house.
I actually have, like, sensations of someone touching me or holding me or, you know, things that happened during the incident. So that's really terrifying.
She's also often afraid to leave her house alone, which posed a problem when the songwriter she was working with asked her to come over and record their song in his studio.
You know, my biggest fear is that something horrible is going to happen. But it didn't. Nothing horrible happened. That was a new tally for the good side.
She didn't tell me until after we sung the song that she'd never been alone in someone else's house for many years.
That's Bob Regan. He's a professional songwriter in Nashville, and he actually founded this whole program called Operation Song several years ago, although originally it was just for soldiers with PTSD. He got the idea while performing on military bases. He realized his decades as a songwriter had turned him into somewhat of a therapist.
It's our job to make the person sitting across from us feel safe and encouraged to open up. She just tells her story, and then together we make it rhyme. You know, I've always been told, keep it to yourself. If you got a problem, don't ever tell. Keep it in a box. Don't touch it. And then if it comes out, shove it back in.
And if it comes out, you better shove it back in. I have soldiered on silently.
This concept of using songwriters to help survivors of trauma is becoming more prevalent across the country. There are now programs like this in Virginia, Texas, and Illinois, among others. But songwriters are, of course, not professional therapists. Regan says it's a lot different than sitting down with another musician and cranking out a song.
The experiences that are likely to come up are much more serious and traumatic by a factor of 10 to 1,000.
It's also a very different experience for the veterans. Katie Minton was 19 when she was serving in the Air Force and sexually assaulted by a colleague she had dated. She's now 30, and she says traditional therapy has helped her get through an eating disorder and some of the trauma. But this adds an extra layer of accomplishment.
It's really cool to see how far I've come, and to put that into a song is pretty cool.
Her song is about remembering being a little girl, not realizing the world is a scary place. Here, songwriter Victoria Banks is performing it in the conference room. Minton didn't want to sing.
Dear me, counting your back handsprings in the yard. Back before you knew that life is hard.
I would love for every veteran to be able to end their therapy with a song.
Michelle Panucci is one of the traditional therapists at the Nashville VA who works with sexual assault clients. She says some of them opened up during their performance today in ways that they haven't even done with her.
Just being able to be bold and saying things about themselves that maybe they're not able to say, you know, one-on-one, and hearing the other women say things in ways maybe that they haven't realized.
I made that choice to find my own.
The veterans and writers grab snacks and congratulate each other. Bob Regan walks over to Sarah Kelly.
If you come up with another song idea, email me. Let's write another one.
Okay.
Kelly grins and says yes. She has much more to say. For The Pulse, I'm Emily Siner.
Dear me, taking on the world at just 18. Finding out it's not as simple as it seems.
Emily Siner is a reporter for WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee.
Don't come easily. I know that sometimes it's hard to smile. Believe that tomorrow you'll be all right. But right now, if I could go back, gonna be okay.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our next story showcases the complicated nature of public health. You can score a major win and then realize you're losing big in a related area. The healthcare system has gotten very good at getting pregnant women who are HIV positive into treatment, ensuring that moms don't transmit the virus to the baby. Women tend to be engaged in their treatment during pregnancy, but what comes next is a problem. Here's Tanya English.
I'm a Philadelphia girl living her life.
This mom is 8 months pregnant, and she has HIV. She doesn't want to use her name on the radio, but says now that she's in her early 30s, she does talk about her status with friends and family because she wants younger people to stay safe.
And if you need condoms, I'll bring them to you, like, you know, strap up. Like, you know what I'm saying? Because it's real. You know what I'm saying? Like I said, a lot of people do not think it can happen to them.
With medicine, the virus in her blood is now undetectable. And because of that, she and her healthcare team at Drexel University College of Medicine are confident that she'll be delivering a healthy baby in just a few weeks.
Yeah, I'm waiting. It's almost over.
How you feeling?
I feel good. I really do. Hungry, but I feel good.
For a mom who's in treatment, the chances of passing the infection on to her baby is less than 1%.
She gets lots of attention. She gets lots of strokes for coming in.
Nurse practitioner Erica Aaron has cared for women with HIV for 25 years. In Philadelphia, where she works, 90% of women who are pregnant and have the virus get some kind of HIV care.
But it's after the pregnancy that then they fall out of care because they're so afraid that someone's going to find out.
Researchers at Drexel in the Philadelphia Health Department just discovered how big the dropout rate is among postpartum women. 3 months after delivery, just 38% of new moms with HIV are still connected to care.
At this point, the women who I see who are not doing well or who are actually unfortunately dying from HIV, it's because of stigma.
How does stigma kill you?
Especially young women are very sensitive about making sure that no one knows. Many of them live alone with this diagnosis, and many of them are afraid to disclose to their partner, not just because of intimate partner violence, but also because they're afraid that they'll be rejected.
There are women who've been outed on Facebook, and Aaron says it's stigma that makes HIV different from managing other chronic illnesses. But it seems like a big ask to expect doctors to treat stigma.
The stigma that we're best able to address is how people feel about themselves living with HIV.
Obstetrician gynecologist Mitchell Besser developed a program in Cape Town, South Africa called Mothers to Mothers. The program hires women with HIV as mentors to support new moms. Besser says when the complications and stresses in someone's life begin to get better, that's when HIV treatment moves up as a priority.
That's true in both Africa and here in Philadelphia. The geography, of course, is very different, but many of the issues that people face are very similar.
Besser was in Pennsylvania to talk about ways to duplicate the Mothers to Mothers program in the United States. He says changing community attitudes about HIV over time is as important as healthcare.
I'm an assistant professor at Drexel College of Medicine. I've been doing HIV-related research for the past 5 to 6 years.
Drexel physician Florence Monplaisir was in training as an infectious disease specialist when she says she realized that her medical expertise isn't nearly enough when a woman is struggling with addiction or when a patient doesn't have a place to live.
It really sort of validated for me the fact that this is real. You know, it's not a theoretical phenomenon. I mean, women are really falling and dying.
Monplaisir remembers one mom with HIV who came in for a checkup about 2 weeks after giving birth. The doctor started the usual workup to figure out the best antiretroviral medicines for the woman. But the patient said what she really needed most was to be back on her anti-anxiety medicine.
So she was really upset at the fact that she had to go to one clinic for her primary care, one clinic for her mental health, and one clinic for her HIV care.
The woman stopped coming in. But Monplaisir kept trying to reach the patient on the phone.
At that point, her sister answered the phone and told me that she had passed away.
It's not clear how the woman died. Besides having untreated HIV and mental health troubles, the patient had been in a long-time domestic violence relationship. She was also an IV drug user. Those are the kinds of life complications that can get in the way. And Monplaisir says the care system has to get better at helping out. But before you can treat a patient, you have to find her.
We live in a neighborhood
where, you know, our clients are.
Marie Spencer works for Philadelphia's St. Christopher's Hospital for Children and basically does detective work, trying to track down women who've dropped out of care.
If I see a person and I know they have children around my grandchild age, I'll go get my grandchild. And then we'll go to that park or kind of sort of walk past their house.
First, Spencer gives patients what they need. She has transit tokens for the bus. She'll bring you formula for a newborn. She offers lunch and friendly hellos.
Hey, how you doing? What's going on?
And that's when Spencer begins to talk about how important it is to keep up treatment. She's good at her job, she says, because she's not a doctor and because she's discreet. Sometimes she goes undercover as an aunt or a neighbor. Once, she pretended to be an old classmate of someone's mom.
You know, so the person that they was with wouldn't pick up that, you know, I was there for, and we gave each other a hug, and I say, while we was hugging, I say, call me.
Hey, how are you?
Once a week, HIV specialist Florence Monplaisir sees her adult patients at the Children's Hospital in North Philadelphia because it's convenient for moms to come in at the same time their child is in for a checkup. One patient says it's like Super Walmart. It's one-stop shopping.
Last time when we met, we talked about starting medications. Yes. And I wanted to see if you put some thought into it and if you feel ready to start.
I am ready to start. I do have my hesitancies, but I am ready to start. And if it's just one pill, I think I can tolerate it.
Nurse practitioner Erica Aaron says today HIV treatment is simpler. But taking medicine every day can be a reminder that you have HIV or a reminder about how you got it.
They say to me, I know I have to take this pill, but for some reason I can't.
But I think some people will say, well, just take the pill. Well, I mean, it's one pill a day. What's the big deal? Can you talk a little bit more about what the big deal is?
Yeah, I can. 60% of the women that I take care of have a history of childhood sexual abuse, which means that they had a horrible sexual experience when they were quite young. They also have a lot of trouble swallowing pills because of that history. The connection most likely is because of being forced to have oral sex and just not being able to swallow pills from that experience.
Back at the clinic with physician Florence Monplaisir. New moms are coming in for follow-up.
Can we do with 10:30 yet?
Yeah, I can do 10:30.
10:30?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Citywide in Philadelphia, about 38% of women with HIV are still in treatment 3 months after giving birth. At the one-stop comprehensive HIV clinics, this year about 72% of postpartum moms were still connected to care 3 months later. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse, I'm Mike and Scott. When medication doesn't work to control the debilitating symptoms of Parkinson's disease, patients have another option, a last resort, brain surgery. A technique known as deep brain stimulation, DBS, targets the areas responsible for the symptoms. DBS has also been used to treat depression and epilepsy. UPenn surgeon Gordon Baltuk has completed 1,000 DBS surgeries. He reached that milestone recently, and he joins us now to talk about it. Gordon, thank you so much for being here.
Mike, and thank you for having me.
What is your role during this procedure? What do you do?
I'm the neurosurgeon who puts the deep brain stimulator into these patients' brain.
And what happens during this procedure in the most simple terms?
In the most simple terms, we take a simple wire and we place it in a structure deep in someone's brain, a structure about the size of a Rice Krispie. We connect that wire to a battery, and we put electricity through that battery and modulate the function of that person's brain in a way as to impact on their disease.
How do you know where to put the wire?
So what we do is we place what we call a stereotactic frame on someone's head, and then we go to and get an MRI of their brain. That converts every point in their brain into an X, Y, and Z coordinate. It's kind of like a GPS of the brain. After that, we can point at that, and then we can figure out how to bring our electrode right to that target through a very small incision on the head.
And the frame, could I imagine it like a helmet perhaps?
Exactly.
What does it look like?
It's like a square, and it's got two pins in front and two pins in back.
So a bit medieval perhaps?
Very medieval.
So if the surgery works right, what can it do for a Parkinson's patient? How does it change their life and their symptoms?
Well, in the classic indication for advanced Parkinson's disease is a patient who has what we call poorly controlled motor fluctuations. They live their life in a sort of roller coaster where they're off and often frozen and slow to where their medications kick in and then overkick in, and they have abnormal movements such as dyskinesias. And often that roller coaster is very unpredictable. What surgery will classically do is will even out that roller coaster, so it goes from being sort of, you know, that, you know, Fahrenheit roller coaster at Hershey Park to sort of the baby roller coaster, which is much more even. And they'll have usually 4 to 6 extra hours of good time in the day where they're not feeling those sort of unpredictable ons and offs.
How did you get interested in this procedure? Where did you learn it?
Interestingly enough, I had trained in Montreal, which had a huge history of epilepsy and movement disorder surgery. At the time in Montreal, when we had patients with Parkinson's disease, we used to make lesions in their brain. And after I finished training, I went for postgraduate training in Switzerland. And I remember they brought a patient with Parkinson's disease. And I asked them, where are we going to make the lesion? And their answer was, we don't make lesions anymore for Parkinson's disease. We put electrodes in and we modulate the brain. And that's when I first really saw that being done for Parkinson's disease. And then when I came back to North America and I took a job at the University of Pennsylvania, there was really a lot of interest in this procedure. And the neurologist saw this as a real potential game changer for the treatment of Parkinson's disease. And then it sort of all took off from there.
How do you get ready for surgery? I don't mean in terms of the work preparation, but you as a person, do you have a ritual?
Yeah, I sort of get my brain into it, you know, literally and figuratively, and focus and sort of realize that there's a lot of stuff that's going on in your life. But right now, your commitment has to be towards the patient and putting this electrode in a certain place. And I think it's a question of really channel and focusing what you need to do and really blotting everything completely out, no matter what it is.
So if you have a water leak or anything like that, it has to go.
Everything gone, gone. You really need to be focused on one thing at that point in time.
How long does the procedure take?
Procedure takes about 6 to 8 hours.
What's the hardest? What takes so long?
I think, you know, there are multiple steps to this procedure, from putting on the stereotactic frame at the beginning to finally implanting the pacemaker, which goes under the clavicle. But the sort of the most involved and difficult portion of this operation is when we are inside the brain with the microelectrodes and finally the stimulator, and really trying to carefully localize where we put this electrode and where we're going to put the stimulator. That's probably the longest and most involved part of this procedure.
Do you ever get nervous doing the surgery? Were you nervous in the beginning?
No, not really. I think I'm actually at my most comfortable in life when I'm in the operating room in general. I mean, the operations always have sort of an excitement to them before every surgery. You know, you're going into something and there's sort of a certain stress around that. But once we sort of get involved, we're so focused on what we are doing. There really isn't, it's sort of, everything else is sort of displaced and you're sort of very focused on getting a successful outcome to your operation.
Gordon, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Gordon Baltuk is the director of the Penn Center for Functional and Restorative Neurosurgery.
But
brain surgery on to plastic surgery. What makes a face feminine? Think about it. No makeup. Is it the chin? Strong chins can look feminine. It works for Angelina Jolie and Grace Jones. Is it the eyebrows? Nope. There's Frida Kahlo. Femininity comes from a combination of several complicated factors, says one of the physicians who pioneered facial feminization surgery. That can make it tricky for people in the transgender community who are thinking about changing their face. Lauren Silverman reports.
In 2006, after Renee Baker started hormone therapy, she decided to have facial feminization surgery. Searching for a doctor back then wasn't easy.
There was probably three or four in the United States that were doing it, so not a ton of options back then.
Baker used savings from her former job as an engineer and pulled together $18,000, a flight to Boston, and a few weeks later.
Describe what your features look like.
Oh boy, you're gonna get me there, aren't you? You know, really just my cheeks are just fuller, my face is rounder. The distance between my eyebrows and my hairline is about a half inch shorter because they kind of raise up your brows and all that. So my eyes are more open and visible, and I kind of like that part.
Her bright blue eyes are the same, but everything else seems softer. She says the surgeon, Dr. Jeffrey Spiegel, took the masculine edge off her face. He's been refining his technique for more than a decade and still remembers the first transgender woman who asked for his help.
I went to the medical literature and I looked up what are the differences between men's and women's faces and what procedures exist to do this. And there was nothing. There was nothing out there.
So Spiegel improvised and the woman liked it.
I was happy that she was happy and I thought that was the end. But then she told someone, and pretty soon it became a very busy part of my practice.
This month, Spiegel's operated on people from a dozen states and seven countries. Their pilgrimage to his Boston office is noteworthy because what they're seeking, some piece of femininity, is a bit elusive. Spiegel says what makes a face feminine and beautiful is easy to generalize, harder to pin down.
It ends up being very deep things. It ends up being the bones. You know, we hear that beauty is only skin deep, but it's not. It has to do a lot with the bones. Now, when we change the face, I need to change the bones. And then the skin is almost like clothing. If a woman puts on a man's shirt, still looks like a woman. So the skin, if it sits in the right way on the facial structures, we start to get the right cues.
Usually, there are multiple parts to a procedure. Everything from an eyebrow raise and lip lift to reshaping the chin and adjusting the Adam's apple. Spiegel bases most of his work at the hairline so he can hide the incisions he makes to lift the skin off the forehead. His tools for reshaping bone are basic: scalpels, saws, chisels, and sometimes small titanium screws to secure the bone.
I do use a laser, which sounds kind of fancy, I suppose. When we do vocal feminization to raise someone's pitch, we use a laser. But otherwise, it's variants of things you could get at Home Depot, I suppose.
What you can't get at Home Depot is a manual for sculpting a feminine nose or eye. Spiegel says you can't just focus on one feature. You have to take into account the entire face. Our brains, he says, are processing shadows and reflections, and that's what we're using to gauge femininity and attractiveness. He says women's faces have a lot of light that bounces off the eyes and the mouth.
Why is this? Well, women have larger cheekbones, which acts like a solar reflector. It bounces light into the eyes. They have small brows, which means there's no visor shading the eyes, so you get a lot more light at the eyes. And an important one is women have shorter upper lips. The upper part of the lip is longer in a man. Therefore, you get less light bouncing off your teeth.
Spiegel says more surgeons are learning the tricks used in facial feminization surgery. Still, only a handful specialize in the techniques. And it doesn't take an economist to figure out that scarcity makes this prohibitively expensive. But Renee Baker says not every transgender woman wants it. And she would know. In her professional life, she counsels people in the LGBT community.
The majority of my clients just want to have their hormones adjusted. It's about getting the hormones right and getting their gender expression to line up with who they feel like their gender identities are.
For her, facial feminization was part of a larger journey. For The Pulse, I'm Lauren Silverman.
Lauren Silverman is a reporter at KERA in Dallas. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Do you want something to contemplate while you're raking leaves this weekend? How about this? Why do leaves change colors? It's a basic question that holds more mystery than you'd expect. Joining us now is Paul Hetzler, a horticulture educator in St. Lawrence County in New York. Paul, thank you so much for being here.
Certainly.
What happens inside of leaves as they change color?
Well, it's interesting because leaves change color because trees kill them. And that's kind of an odd thing to say. But as the days get shorter and cooler, trees, deciduous trees that is, decide that they need to shut down the sugar factory for the season. And they do this based on sort of their energy budget. So they're busy putting a waxy substance between the leaf stem and the twig that is going to eventually block off all the plumbing, if you will. If they didn't do that, the twig would become damaged in the winter. So as they block off the plumbing, the chlorophyll dies off, and that is the green molecule, of course, that's at the heart of photosynthesis. And as the chlorophyll dies off, some of the other pigments that are present in the leaf but covered by the green chlorophyll begin to become more evident.
Is that where the yellow comes in and perhaps the red?
Well, that's another interesting thing because when I was a child... you know, in school we were taught, well, the chlorophyll dyes and all the other colors are there to begin with. But as you mentioned, the yellow is already there and the orange range as well. But red is unique in that the tree has to make that in the fall.
And do we know why trees would go through that extra effort of making the red?
Well, that's kind of a fun question because we do not know. There are a lot of conjectures. And it turns out that this red pigment is a very large, cumbersome organic molecule. It's called anthocyanin. It takes a lot of energy to create this pigment. And there are reasons that plants use this pigment at other times of the season. But in the fall, it doesn't really make sense for them to spend a lot of energy making this pigment. But I could tell you some of the hypotheses if you'd like.
Yeah, I was wondering, people must be working on that, right?
Yes. Yeah, hopefully they have better things to do as well. But yes, so, you know, one of the hypotheses is that this is a sunscreen. This is a protectant to protect chlorophyll from UV damage. And it turns out the UV damage is even greater at lower temperatures. So plants do make this in the springtime, and you'll see reddish leaves sometimes with young plants coming out. And the plants are investing in this expensive, if you will, molecule to protect young leaves. But in the fall, it really doesn't make sense that they're making a sunscreen. So another thought is that, well, this red color repels herbivores. And again, you think, well, wait, they're getting rid of these leaves. They're actually literally killing them off. Why would they invest to repel herbivores? And then a third hypothesis is that this red pigment acts as a chemical inhibitor for other species to germinate and compete against whatever tree is making this red color. But that, again, is kind of silly because these leaves will primarily fall near the tree, we assume. The tree really doesn't want its offspring under it. It would like its offspring elsewhere, and that's why we have very light seeds that tend to float away. And maples are famous for making these red pigments, and their seeds are helicopters that are windborne. And all in all, I'd say that science doesn't know, and that's fine. You know, these mysteries are kind of, well, I think they're fun, actually. I love it that we have to admit that we don't know.
Well, maybe the trees do this just for us. Which regions, in your opinion, have the best fall colors? That's always a big competition, right?
Well, there are many regions of the world that have a very brilliant leaf color change. I mean, objectively, it's not just because I live in the Northeast, but objectively, I think in the Northeast, it's really one of the best in the whole world. And there are several reasons for this. For one thing, we have a great diversity of hardwood trees here. And, you know, like in Europe, for example, you know, we have, I believe it's something on the order of 10 times or even more the number of different tree species here than there.
What are the weather conditions that produce the best results in terms of color?
Adequate soil moisture. So if you go into fall with the soil too dry, that can mute the colors. And we have a rather reasonably extended fall. In other words, not an early frost. That really puts an end to the really good colors. And then the other thing would be clear skies. So we would like sunny days and fairly cool, although not freezing, nights.
Paul, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Hetzler is a horticulture educator in St. Lawrence County, New York. It's The Pulse, and here's another mystery that science can solve. If you've been to a birthday party as a kid or you watched the movie My Best Friend's Wedding, then you know that helium makes your voice sound squeaky.
Like the mountains in springtime, come love me.
Pulse reporter Carolyn Beeler was wondering, why is that? So she went to find out and joins us now. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Mikan.
So, what did the investigation bring to light?
Well, I decided to ask Franklin Institute Chief Bioscientist Jayatri Das to come to the studio and explain this phenomenon to me. She did, and as requested, she brought balloons. So let's take a listen to that conversation. So we're both going to just take a deep breath out of a balloon filled with helium.
And now I sound like this.
You sound kind of like a mouse or a chipmunk.
A little Donald Ducky. We can take another breath.
Okay.
Big breath this time. Ooh,
oh, there you go.
So funny.
Now you got a good one going.
So tell me why we sound like this. What's going on here?
When you talk, your vocal cords vibrate at a particular frequency or rate, and the movement of your vocal cords then pushes the air around it in your voice box. And that motion of air causes a sound wave that then gets picked up by the ears of your listener.
Okay, so sound is really just sound waves hitting our eardrums, basically.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, what's different when you inhale the helium is that instead of having air in your voice box, you have helium in your voice box. And helium is a lot lighter than air. And so sound waves move about 3 times faster through helium than they do through air. So that makes it sound different to our ears.
But it's not actually the pitch that's changing like I thought it was, because pitch is controlled by how quickly your vocal cords vibrate, and that stays the same. So your voice isn't actually higher, but what does change is something called sound quality. Now, that's kind of amorphous, and it's best described with an example.
Imagine different musical instruments. So say that you have a piano and a violin, and they both play middle C. They're playing the exact same frequency or pitch, but you know which one's the piano and which one's the violin because right. They have different sound qualities.
Piano? Violin.
So that's what's changing here. Your voice is still vibrating at the same frequency, but the difference in the gas that's moving creates a different sound quality.
Now, your voice is made up of a bunch of different sound qualities, and when your voice is traveling faster through helium than it would through air,
essentially, the higher frequencies become stronger. They're amplified over the lower frequencies.
So, Mikan, if you want just the basic explanation, there it is. Sound waves moving faster through helium amplify the higher sounding tones and make the lower ones drop out.
But how so? How does that happen?
Okay, if you want to get a little bit deeper, we're going to have to really nerd out here with the science.
Nerd away.
All right, so your voice box naturally resonates when certain wavelengths hit it, and that amplifies those tones. Now, when sound moves faster through helium, all of the wavelengths get stretched out, the higher sounding ones and the lower sounding ones. So those lower wavelengths get so long that they don't fit right in your voice box anymore to make it vibrate. So your vocal tract doesn't amplify those lower tones anymore, so they just sort of fade away. But it does amplify the tones that sound higher, which are stretched out now to be the perfect size to be amplified by your vocal tract.
All right.
So hardcore science done. But Jayatri wasn't done with me with just the helium. She brought 2 more balloons that were not helium.
These balloons are filled with a gas called sulfur hexafluoride. And the way that helium is lighter than air, sulfur hexafluoride is much heavier than air. Want to give it a try?
Yeah, absolutely. Ooh. Okay, all right. 3, 2, 1.
Okay, this is what sulfur hexafluoride sounds like. Ooh. It sounds sort of like I'm being anonymized on a hidden camera show or something like that.
I was thinking you almost had a bit of a Barry White thing going.
I bet it would be a better singer on sulfur hexafluoride.
But you That's can hilarious. See
how it kind of flattens your voice if a little bit.
Listen closely here as the sulfur hexafluoride starts to wear off.
And you can hear, now that it's starting to die out, all of those other frequencies come back into play. My voice sounds richer,
even though
I'm still speaking in the same pitch, in the same volume.
It's that sound quality that changes as I'm talking, as the air returns back to my voice box. So, Maiken, as you can hear, with sulfur hexafluoride, the sound waves are shorter, so the lower tones in your voice are amplified and the higher ones end up fading out. But don't try this at home. A little helium or sulfur hexafluoride isn't going to hurt you, but breathing them in does prevent oxygen from getting to your brain, which is not good long term.
I still want to try it, though.
Okay, good. I did save you a balloon.
All right. Which one is this?
This is the sulfur hexafluoride.
All right. Here we go.
Big breath.
Is that big enough? Oh my gosh. That is so strange. That's a career ender, right?
Well, thank you, Carolyn. It does thankfully go away eventually, right? So I'm just going to keep talking. You're listening to The Pulse. And I am Maiken Scott, even though I don't sound like her right now.
Right, my voice is back to normal, mostly. And before we go, the science of gene editing reached new levels this week. Scientists at the University of California who were working on fruit flies say they found a way to quickly push changes through an entire species, basically bypassing the rules of genetics. They were using a gene drive, a sequence of DNA that can greatly increase the odds of offspring inheriting a gene mutation, and combined that with new genetic editing techniques. Ethan Beer, the biologist who heads the lab where this was discovered, says it's a game changer. It holds a lot of promise in combating some of the world's worst diseases like malaria or West Nile virus. There's also serious concern that once you start messing with this kind of thing, it could upset the delicate balance of the ecosystem in unexpected ways. But if we just dream for a moment, what comes to mind is Dr. Seuss's famous, "Oh, the places you'll go. You have brains in your head, you have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself any direction you choose." So here's our little pulse wish list of things we would create. Mosquitoes that can't bite at all, or at least not give us diseases. Listener Shannon Wink encourages us to think bigger. Get rid of mosquitoes altogether. Birds that make clear poop, bedbugs that just want to cuddle, Twitter follower Joe H. wants chipmunks that harmonize and sing in key. He also wants cats without an attitude. Reporter Carolyn Beeler wants a cat without claws and dolphins that let you ride them. Reporter Todd Bookman wants a dog you don't have to walk. Which brings us back to Dr. Seuss. Simple it's not, I'm afraid you'll find, for a mind maker upper to make up his mind. And with that, we have to go. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Tanin Dariush is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, our associate producer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or on our website, whyy.org/The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.